The Mystery and Art of Living, a conversation with On Being host Krista Tippett. You know Krista Tippett as the host of On Being, a nationally distributed public radio program and podcast that each week explores questions of meaning, belief, and what it means to be human. Tippett is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author. Her book, Becoming Wise, is just now out in paperback, and in it, she expands on what she's learned over her career, interviewing theologians, poets, activists, scientists, people from all walks of life. Today, we'll ask about some of the themes that reappear in her interviews, themes such as the impact of community and the relationship between science and belief. And of course, we want to hear from you. A main calling conversation with Krista Tippett is next, but first, this news update. I'm Keith Shortall. This is Main Calling. Early in her most recent book, Becoming Wise, Krista Tippett writes that, quote, "My work has shown me that spiritual geniuses of the everyday are everywhere." As the host of the public radio program On Being, and over the course of her distinguished career, Krista has spoken with, and perhaps more importantly, listened to, people from just about every walk of life. She shares some of what she's learned in Becoming Wise. Krista is on the line with us. She's a Peabody and award-winning broadcaster, a New York Times best-selling author, and you can hear her on our air Sunday mornings when we broadcast her program On Being. Krista Tippett, welcome to the program.
Hi, Keith. I'm so glad to be with you.
A little shaky there at the beginning, but we're all together.
I know. Yeah, well, technology, count on technology,
I know,
too.
Right? Our phone number,
1-800-399-3566.
You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Main Calling, or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. I want to start out by asking you about this past election and how and whether it revealed more clearly some of the forces that have been building in American society, specifically maybe the powerful force known as fear.
Yeah, well, fear is a powerful force in human life and in human brains. I think the forces building in American society have kind of triggered that. The forces building in global society, I mean, for me, this last year to two of politics has been, I see the politics as a symptom of a human drama, which is another way of saying what I think you said. And, you know, we live in this moment of the ground shifting beneath our feet, and that for some being feeling more perilous and more threatening than for others. I just think it's true that we're in this moment of great flux and change, and we're not exactly hardwired for that. And globalization and, you know, these amazing technologies that have completely reoriented our lives and that are restructuring our institutions evolve so rapidly, more rapidly than our ability to kind of shape them to human purposes and get a sense of how they work for human beings. And you know, that and then the details of how that has revealed itself has kind of thrown us back to these very primal places in ourselves where we run for cover.
You had pointed out that, for example, though we are pretty good at responding to recognizable crisis, you know, World War II, for example, and we rally around and get to the business of saving the world. We're not so good, though, at dealing with uncertainty.
Yeah. We live in this moment of just these vast open questions. And we're redefining basic things that pretty much everybody thought not that long ago. These things that have been defined, like marriage and family and community and gender and, you know, the internet and its advent in our lives is throwing up for grabs the meaning of authority and leadership and belonging and human relationship, how it happens. And when you start to to open those ideas and realities up, you're going to have to reinvent, restructure everything you do. Yeah, and we are not made for that. Some of us, a few of us, are made for that. I will say because it's also a wellspring of creativity. I will say what's interesting about 2017 as opposed to 2016 is that I think it feels less like a period of uncertainty and more kind of all around like a period of crisis and urgency. And we are better equipped to rise to a moment like this. I find right now people are very awake and activated. And, of course, that can go either way. But to me, that's the promising side of this moment.
And that's, though, because certain players in 2016 created the enemies that we could identify or at least play the role of the enemy. In the case of Bernie Sanders, it was Wall Street. In the case of Donald Trump, it was immigrants. And so do you think that we are better than we know what to do when we have clearly identified enemies, even though we're polarized in who we think those enemies are?
I agree with you that that those campaigns in their very different ways play to where people go, whether cynically or not, to where our brains go when we feel threatened. And that's not the place where we rise to our best selves. I do also think that the flip side of that reality, which we don't investigate and explore and shine a light on as much, is that there is now a lot of turning to one another in a way that feels new from the last couple of years. There are numbers of bodies on the street. But I also see in communities, in families, although families are kind of the hardest places for this, but in communities, in groups of parents, in civic organizations, there are a lot of people very searchingly asking the question of, what is common life? How did we become so fractured? What can I do in the world right around me to be a force for generative change? How can I reach out? And that is how common life gets stitched one life at a time. That, too, is happening now.
So is that a silver lining, if you will, of this? Or is it just necessary to maybe undo some of this polarization? Is that the positive side?
Well, I might flip it and say, let's look at this another way. In a very short number of years, we went from being a collection of nation states on disconnected continents to living in a globalized world to being interconnected with the rest of humanity. This is completely unprecedented in the history of our species. And, of course, it has brought all kinds of progress, and it's brought all kinds of dislocation. It's had winners, it's had losers in that equation. Here's the positive way to say it is we have the tools, we are equipped for the very first time in the history of our species to think and act like a species, as a species. I mean, that's incredible. But as I say, it happened so quickly, and it's very incomplete. And it wasn't shaped to human purposes. And so I feel like all over the world, not just in American politics, there's Brexit in the UK, all over the world, there is a reaction now. We probably could have predicted this. And I do feel like a lot of the moves to hunker down, to get smaller rather than bigger, to define over against. Again, these are places our minds and our bodies go, and they are a form of short-term comfort, and we actually have to be a bit compassionate about that. But they're a reaction to change that is underway. So I wouldn't say so much that what's happening now has created all these new realities. I would say that they are reacting to realities. And how we, I mean we, all of us, each and every one of us in our places, how we work with what's happening, and I think how we are generative in creating and inhabiting new realities as much as how we are resisting, which is, you know, another word that's out there a lot now. Reactionary in the traditional sense is that it's a reaction to change that is already happening, that is underway, that is inevitable. I don't necessarily think that what is in fact good for us that has been underway can't be rolled back. But I want us to keep in mind how much momentum there is for us to actually be growing up, as opposed to acting like adolescence, which is one way to say, you know, this moment in time that we are in the adolescence of our species. It's a tumultuous time. It's a perilous time, and it's also a time where great things can be born and launched.
You have experience as a journalist as well, and we'll talk about that too. But I'm wondering, do you think that what you're describing, what's happening quietly of this community of people reaching to help each other, to recognize each other, is something that's just not getting covered in the news as much as the exciting, polarized moments of anger?
It's just not. And I'm sure you've thought about this as well. I think all of us, I think public radio thinks about this. You know, the bad news is riveting. The things that are scary are riveting. I mean, they're literally riveting. They land in your body in a different way. One of the stories that I just love that I've heard recently that I'm just walking around with is a group. I was in Iowa and was hearing about a group of parents. This was right after the election. About half of them voted for Donald Trump, about half of them voted for Hillary Clinton, but each and every one of them was really concerned about the effect the election and the discourse and the tenor of the election had had on their children. And so they weren't getting together to talk about politics, but they were getting together to talk about what they had a common stake in, which was their love of their children, and they were honoring that in each other. And they're talking about civic life, and they're talking about, you know, how you listen and how you work with difference. That's how common life gets woven. But it's, you know, it's never going to be a news headline. So I think it's important. And I think the kind of journalism that I do, the kind of journalism you do, it's a bit quieter. And those of us who have platforms, and not just journalistic platforms, to honor these kinds of stories as serious and as meaningful as those things that are terrifying and corrupt and failing, that this too is the story of our time. This is important for us to all see the fullness of the story of our time and the fullness of its potential beyond the distressing things and the dramatic things that really dominate, the news.
You like to begin conversations by asking your subjects to describe, and I'm paraphrasing here, but describe their spiritual experience in childhood or something like that.
Yeah.
why do you start that way?
Okay. Yeah. Well, so first of all, I want to say it's a total contrast in terms of the response it elicits to the question I might ask, which is, tell me about your spiritual life, right? Or do you have a religious life now? This is such an intimate part of us. And that question would leave just about everybody mortified and tongue-tied, including me. But to ask somebody, what I say is, was there a religious or spiritual background to your childhood? Mm-hmm. And I actually have found over the years that just about everybody has a really interesting story to tell. And it might be a story of presence. It might be a story of absence, wherever they are on the spectrum now. But the real reason I ask that question is because it sends people. So whereas if you ask somebody about their spiritual life now, they, you know, we would get it would, that would be a kind of defended answer, right? Kind of trying to explain. And the spiritual background of your childhood takes people to a very soft, searching place in themselves. And it's a place where lots of questions live. And it's very interesting how on the course of interviews I have, you know, often those questions then get woven into the whole rest of the interview. And the main reason I ask it is because of where it plants them, but then also plants the conversation in that soft searching place, where something different can happen, where they may put words about something that they wouldn't put around in a situation where from the beginning they felt like they were there to explain or defend or present. And those are more familiar modes that we put people in and that we, you know, we turn up prepared to be in.
Yeah, frankly. I'll ask you about your childhood and with respect to, I guess, your spiritual experiences then. But we're going to take a quick break first. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number here, 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, welcoming visitors to the Michael Klar Center on the University of Maine Augusta campus, hhrcmaine.org.
On the next Fresh Air, addictive technology, from our smartphones to immersive online games. We'll talk with Adam Alter, author of the new book Irresistible, about how our digital devices are contributing to the rise of behavioral addictions, such as compulsive video game playing and online shopping. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Jewish Film Festival, taking place in Portland, Waterville, Brunswick, and Lewiston, has a wide array of film screenings, documentaries, and events this year, and takes place from Saturday, March 18th through Saturday the 25th. Maine Public members receive a special ticket price. Go to mainepublic.org and click on Events for all the details. And tonight at 8 o'clock on Maine Public Television, join us for Hamilton's America. Great Performances follows the creation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's pop culture Broadway phenomenon Hamilton and the history behind it. That's coming up tonight at 8 o'clock on the stations of Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a conversation with Krista Tippett, host of On Being. We're talking about her book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Krista, I wanted to ask you about your childhood experiences in Oklahoma. Your grandfather was a strict, I guess it's fair to say, Baptist preacher, Southern Baptist preacher.
Yes.
And you talk pretty honestly about what that kind of religion, I guess, in retrospect, looked like to you, about it being about rules.
Yeah.
But how did that affect, I guess, your either your interest or your view of spirituality and religion as you grew up?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was mostly about things you couldn't do. Right? It was about rules and how terrifying it would be to break them, but they were just everywhere around to be broken all the time. But my grandfather, I think, you know, when you ask me how it formed me as I moved beyond it, my grandfather was also full of contradiction, as we all are. But he was kind of larger than life contradictions, you know, this hellfire and brimstone preacher, but also very loving, very funny, very playful in a way that the other adults around me weren't. And so, I mean, I actually think that internalizing that, you know, what is it? There we contain multitudes, you know, knowing that early on. My grandfather also had a second grade education. And at some point, and I don't know how much I was aware of this as a child, but I was aware of it as I ended up getting a fine education and, you know, going far away. I understood that he had I really think my grandfather was profoundly intelligent, that he had a big mind. He could do amazing things with mathematical equations. And his love of his Bible, of the text, was profound. But because he hadn't been invited to the life of the mind for him was not invited to be part of his faith. And I actually think the life of the mind terrified him. And that really formed me. And as I grew older, you know, there's some sense in which I think I take delight in asking questions that he would have been terrified to ask, and like making it okay and revealing how life-giving and thrilling and expanding it is to let those questions be out there alongside whatever we are convicted about, to let wonder be part of the equation.
And you discovered, as you said, when you went abroad, and in particular to divided Berlin, that those mm-hmm. those conversations were sort of everywhere. They were, there was no fear of talking about those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah, although, so when I was in divided Berlin, there was no fear about, you know, asking the big existential questions of humanity, which at that time, I mean, the big political existential questions, which at that time were about nuclear weapons and the Cold War. But what I started to realize there after a few years is that realm, I mean, I was with, you know, ambassadors and nuclear arms experts, diplomats, leading military people, and then also in that world of mid-80s divided Berlin, this emerging green movement, which would become, you know, so huge and established eventually. It was very radical and nobody knew whether to take it seriously or not. But in that realm, there was an impoverished vocabulary for talking about meaning, or for actually acknowledging all these contradictory impulses that make us human, and that actually thwart politics, because we in fact are not logical creatures, and we don't always do what would be best for us to do. And so that was in that experience that I started asking questions about, you know, where I wanted to be active, and then eventually decided I wanted a theological education to kind of to look at the world as I had seen it, and with all the complexity I knew it to have, and then to bring this other line of inquiry back into it.
Then you found your way to the radio eventually.
Yeah.
As some of us have. Explain how that came about. It was in Minnesota?
Yeah, well, but, you know, I love radio, and I started loving radio living in Germany and then in the UK for a little while. So I loved the BBC, and I loved BBC Four, which is unlike, you know, the World Service is what people hear over here, but it's the domestic BBC. And then, yes, then I ended up flukishly in Minnesota, which is just a very vibrant public radio network here. And I had been a journalist. I had gotten this theological education. I felt like there was this big black hole where we didn't know how to speak in public or in good journalism about this whole part of life, the religion, spirituality, moral imagination, ethical imagination. We were squeezing our deliberation of those things into political boxes and political modes of discourse, and we were handing them over to a few very strident voices, you know, who made for great sound bites, but really betrayed the very spirit of what they were presenting to the world. And so then I started to think that public radio would be a place where one could pick up this subject of this part of life and apply these these values of balance and intelligence and do something that would open imaginations up rather than shut them down. Just as I feel, you know, we aspire to do that with politics and with economics and with the arts.
So with this book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living, I know the title came very late to you in the writing process here, but it does describe this exploration of virtues by way of past conversations with wise people that you've had on the radio and elsewhere. And I was struck by, in one section, you describe wise people as embodying both power and tenderness in a way that is jarring.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is, I guess, describes your perception of them.
Yeah, I've been asked sometimes, and in some ways the book was a long answer to the question of, you know, what is it? What are the recurring themes? Like, you know, what are the qualities of having a wise and graceful life? But I can also describe the physicality of it. I mean, it has an embodied, it is something that you feel as much as you hear the words or know the person. And it is... and I think about people like Jean Vanier is the person I was sitting in front of in the book when I wrote that in the book. But it's also, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh or Desmond Tutu or Wan Gari Maathai. It is this embodied, they hold together these very, very wise people in their presence, great power and great tenderness. And yeah, that's not the paradigm we have of power culturally, and it's a very unfamiliar experience, and a little confusing, but in a really interesting way.
Yeah, 1-800-399-3566 to talk with Krista Tippett. Let's go to Waterville and Ellery. Hi, Ellery. Welcome to the program.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Sure. Yes, I have a zest for being, and its many profound curiosities. So Dr. Tippett's program just delightfully illustrates that joy in being, and I thank her so much for that program. My question is, in a few words, if I can possibly make it, in a 50-minute span, how does Dr. Tippett craft of a few questions and yet still manages to encourage her guests to summarize and share this profound, this extensive wisdom into combining hope and science and philosophy and theology and inspiration and all that to become a being? I mean, it's just amazing how Dr. Tippett does this on her show. And I was wondering if there's a secret to it.
Well, thank you. And I love the idea. I love the zest for being language. Well, I appreciate there is a craft to it. And you know, it's different from a live show like this one, where whatever happens, happens. So I will say that, you know, I have about 90 minutes of a conversation, and I do a lot of preparation to really be able to be present from the very beginning of the conversation, not just to what people know, but how they think, and to create in that way a hospitable atmosphere in which I think people can really sink down into their depths. And that I get to experience them there, and that the listener gets to experience them there. And then, as I say, I do have kind of a wandering 90-minute conversation. And there are things that happen in a conversation when you let somebody walk down a side road for 5 or 10 minutes that you can't do in a show like this, but that I can allow them to do that. And then there's some treasure at the end of that side road. And then we do... You know, we do. There is. You know, I'm very gifted with colleagues who kind of do this art and craft of radio with the editing, and the music, and the pacing, and the script, and I hope what. And the point of all of that is to really, you know, what we were doing is interviewing somebody we believe people will like to know about and like to hear from and be nourished by, and so we can really craft that hour to create that experience.
Ellery?
Excellent answer. Thank you very much.
So that's the secret.
Secret.
Let's try to go to Biddeford now and Liz. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the program. Liz, can you hear us? Okay, I don't think we have, we don't have Liz. I know her question, though, is she wanted to talk about the changes she's noticed in herself since the campaign, how it's changed her. Her first reactions were terror and confusion, and then moving to eager to get outrage, now trying to separate from that.
Separate from the outrage.
Yeah. So have you found that people are undergoing changes over time as they respond to the election?
Yes. You know, there has been a lot of emotion out on the surface of our public life here for a while. And I was very aware all through the campaign, especially the last year, that, you know, there was a lot of pain and fear that was fueling the Trump campaign. And then I felt like when he won, you suddenly had a lot of pain and fear fueling the Democratic side. And so we were all in the same boat. But it is a boat that is not destined to help us rise to our best selves. What I was aware of all year as well, and what I was focused on, is whoever had won in November, the work ahead of us was clear, and it was this restitching of common life and figuring out what that is going to mean in this century. And so I kind of think that this trajectory that she describes is one that a lot of people are on. And I think outrage, you know, confusion, terror, outrage are absolutely are understandable places, but where we need to get is and those can be ways to get to, okay, so what do I build, right? How do I create this reality I want to inhabit, I want my children to inhabit? And yeah, that's the curve. I do think it's going to be really dangerous for us if all around, on every side of the political spectrum, we can't find ways to walk ourselves and walk with others out of outrage and into something generative.
I'm wondering about whether, you know, some might fear that something in the American DNA, its genetic cultural makeup, makes it such that it's lends itself to being polarized, that a version of America that somehow creates the community that you talk about can happen without significant change. It's sort of.
Yeah, I mean, we've been walking into this polarization for a long, long time, you know, and I don't know. And then we're so shocked when it tips over into something full blown, but. We have this project that we kind of tend at the heart of what we do called the Civil Conversations Project. And we started that in 2011 after the Gabrielle Giffords shooting. And, you know, what I remember when I think back to that is 2010 had been this very polarized, it was, you know, toxic, feral language. So that when that shooting happened at a political event outside a supermarket, you couldn't draw a direct line between, you know, the election and what happened. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't prove it in court. But there was this kind of all around kind of taking a breath and saying, oh, you know, we are creating an atmosphere. We are all creating an atmosphere in which that kind of thing can happen. What we didn't know how to do after that is start uncreating that atmosphere. And so, you know, very quickly we slip back into the polarization, and now it's full blown. And I don't know, this may be our version of hitting bottom, that we finally say this is untenable. We won't be part of this. I think the part of the dynamic now is that the national political level is so deeply dysfunctional. And that's really confusing when that is the level to which we want to look. And, you know, we've all been trained. That's where leadership comes. This will be where we see the way forward. This is where leadership is modeled. And that's not happening, and it hasn't been happening in a fulsome way for a while. What is interesting, though, I think, is how local government, you know, mayors are so interesting right now. People are getting engaged in civic organizations very close to home, and there's a vibrancy to that. There's kind of a renewal of political life at that level, which I think we have to factor in.
Yeah,
when we start generalizing about polarization. But yeah, it's all emergent, you know.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your questions for Krista Tippett. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Mills Entertainment, presenting Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood live at Merrill Auditorium this Thursday, March 16th. Tickets and details at porttix.com.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Viet Thanh Nguyen. Nguyen is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer, and most recently, a collection of short stories called The Refugees. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. For years, Maine Public Television has offered a safe harbor for children's educational television viewing during the weekday daytimes. And we still do. But now we also offer a brand new digital channel, PBS Kids. 24/7 commercial-free educational children's programming that you can trust whenever you want. And that's not it, wherever you want as well. We also offer PBS Kids for online streaming on your mobile devices. To find out more, visit mainepublic.org and click on television or see your Experience member magazine. PBS Kids is our digital channel and, similar to World and Create, can be seen over the air and on most cable channels in our state. Enjoy.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation about the art of living. On the line with us is Krista Tippett. She's the Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and New York Times best-selling author. Her new book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Anne in Portland. Hi, Anne.
Yes, hello, Keith. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. It's delightful to hear Krista. Krista, I'm a Sunday morning listener, so I want to thank you for that wonderful way to start my Sunday morning. I also spent some time with John O'Donohue. I'm from Ireland, as you can probably hear. And I have the podcast, two of them actually, of your unedited interview with John O'Donohue, the Irish poet and mystic. And I also have the edited version, but I want to thank you for those. And I just, back to the childhood question that you ask, having grown up in Ireland, what I will tell you is that what I've held on to in my spiritual life is my connection to nature. And I want to thank you for that question to me, but also you're familiar with Karen Armstrong.
Yes.
And her Charter for Compassion. Because earlier on, you were speaking with Keith about the turmoil that we seem to be in right now. But I do find that her work internationally is really calling us to a much higher level of being.
All right, Anne, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. I have to say that I think that if we have an all-time greatest hits on being episode, it is that conversation with John O'Donohue. It speaks to so many people, and it speaks to people at different moments. And I think that that connection with nature that you described is also that Celtic sensibility, which is just such a gift, and something that, you know, people are rediscovering in this culture as well. And I would agree. The Charter for Compassion is actually a good example of these kind of counter movements to the very well publicized, kind of demise of compassion in politics, and it's important to just keep our eyes on those things as well.
Talk a bit about the word compassion. I think I'd seen in some discussions that, you know, that the word itself has kind of lost its power. I mean, it seems like a passive kind of word that it doesn't deserve to be.
Yeah, it's one of these words that's overused, but I don't know, it's like a lot of words that we need the most. You know, I think justice is another word. Love is another word. The words themselves don't necessarily carry all the connotations they have when we speak them or all the meaning that they have where they have meaning. You know, Karen Armstrong actually tells a story about a speech she gave or something she wrote was translated into another language, and all the way through it was translated, compassion was translated as pity, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's not the vibrant, muscular meaning of compassion that changes lives. I'm fascinated that the root for the word compassion in both Hebrew and Arabic is connected to the word for womb, which is this very fierce, interdependent, lifelong relationship. And I think compassion, you know, I don't know how many people would disagree with the statement that compassion is something the 21st century needs. The question is, how do we go about embodying that and filling the word, I think, with new practical connotations by living it and by having that be seen and experienced?
Let's go to Bangor and Alejandro. Hi, Alejandro.
Hi. I've been listening. It was actually, I started with speaking of faith when I was in grad school studying philosophy. And one of the things I was always struck by was your ability to ask questions that got at people's sort of core beliefs, and kind of was interested in how you developed that skill, and if you had any ideas of places that I could turn to kind of work on that practice.
We should explain that Speaking of Faith was On Being that was its name before it was On Being.
Yeah.
The name of the show.
Yeah.
Yep.
Until 2011, I think. 2011. Well, Alejandro, thank you for the question. I think the word, you know, you use the word practice, and this is all something I have practiced now for many years. I've kind of done my Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours, and I've written. We have a website called civilconversationsproject.org, and on that there is a resource. I think the ACT is the link on the website, and we have created something called Better Conversations, a Starter Guide, and that's not a kind of linear answer to your question, but that was a place in creating that I try to break down some of the things that I've learned by doing. That was actually a really interesting experiment for me. And it does, we talked earlier about that opening question. I think the opening, where you start a conversation, is absolutely critical in terms of how revealing and open someone is going to be for the rest of the time you have together, and how much they might even surprise themselves by putting words maybe around core beliefs that they hadn't put words around before. And I think also that work of hospitality, of being prepared, you know, being welcoming. If I'm very, very prepared, we've all had the experience of sitting down across from somebody, and this communicates itself physically as before any words are spoken or after just a few words are spoken. If you have the feeling, this person understands me, I can relax and go deeper. Or if you have the feeling, This is one where I'm going to have to explain myself. I'm going to have to defend myself. That intentionality that you bring into a conversation just makes a huge amount of difference.
One thing I'm wondering if we've lost is this ability to disagree but respect the other person's position. It's almost as if we disagree, we're angry at the other person and dismiss everything about them in some ways. There are other cultures, other religions even, where this is much easier to do. I'm just wondering, is that part of building the community that you talk about?
Yeah, I actually think we don't have a very sophisticated way of navigating difference. And the way we've kind of done it since the 60s, or the way we want to think it could work, is that, you know, we were tolerant of each other. And so you could have your opinion over there, I have my opinion, you have your convictions, you have your identity, I have my convictions, I have my identity. Every once in a while we get together, and then if we have a mode for engaging that, it's the debate, right? Or it's the vote. Somebody wins, somebody loses. Or you find common ground, you get on the same page. But you're right, if you don't in that model, we don't have ways of staying in the room and being in relationship and letting that, you know, being in conversation, being in relationship, and letting that be a higher value than whether we agree with each other. Although the one thing I like to point out is that we have a lot of intelligence in our private lives that it would behoove us to apply to public life, which is, after all, just a larger, wider circle of human beings. For one thing, you know, one thing that we tend to do, neuroscientists will tell us, is that when we look at another group or, you know, another opinion group, we tend to imagine a homogeneity that's not there in our own most immediate circles of friends and families. But in our own most immediate intimate circles of friends, families, old friends, you know, coworkers, there are people who we have chosen to stay in relationship with, who we love. And part of the way we do that is by deciding what we will not talk about with them. Like that's also a way of respecting someone. I think right now we have to acknowledge that for a few generations, I mean, this kind of goes back to earlier on, the idea that we live in this moment of these vast open questions. You know, we are really recharting some civilizational territory. We're not going to get to our destination where everybody's on the same page anytime soon. And yet we need to live together peacefully and creatively and graciously. And so what if we focused on that rather than agreement, disagreement, positions, debates? I also, you know, I'm not saying we put all these things to one side. I'm not saying that some of this doesn't have to be discussed right now. It does. But if we could get some muscle memory about practicing, you know, being in relationship, about getting in the room with the people we don't understand, about having hard conversations about important subjects where the framing of that is what is at stake for all of us in this conversation as opposed to who's going to win the debate, then we can develop some modes of speaking, some modes of being in the room, so that when we do take up those hard questions again, when we do bring our opinions in, it's going to be in the context of a relationship.
So for this to work, then, it's not going to be some mass media campaign to change people's mind, but daily the daily exercise of individuals to literally practice.
It is a daily lived practice. And, you know, part of the problem, I think one of the biggest problems that we have right now is that we don't even know how to get into the room with the people who we know we need to be in conversation with, the people we really know we don't understand. We don't have to be in the room with the most strident example of what we disagree with, right? That's another thing we do wrong. Like in media, we frame everything in terms of the extreme poles. But, you know, one of my deep convictions is that left of center, right of center, all the way up to those extreme poles, most of us have some questions alongside our answers and some curiosity alongside our convictions, and we actually understand that we have to live together with people on the other side because we share this world and because we all love our children. So we need to step outside our comfort zone a little bit to make those kinds of encounters possible. I mean, like these parents I mentioned. I think, you know, one way for us to just start thinking about how we might find in our own life some of these points of connection is could we start getting together with other people around questions we share, as opposed to issues or positions we disagree on.
Right. And on that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Okay. Right in the middle of a thought. But I really appreciate you being here, Krista. It was a great conversation. Thank you
so much. Thanks for the great questions. And I love being on Maine Public Radio and speaking to your community.
All right. Thank you so much. Krista Tippett, host of the public radio program On Being. Her new book, which is now in paperback, is Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. You can hear Krista's program On Being right here on Maine Public Radio on Sunday mornings. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about how best to build science literacy. Learn exactly what science literacy is and how some are trying to encourage more of us to develop a passion in understanding science. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.